Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from Edvest and You, a loan product of the NEEF Network, a local nonprofit agency providing college student loans and student loan refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. School's out across New Hampshire, and many educators are pausing to take a breath as they reflect on the sudden and unprecedented shift to remote learning this spring. Meanwhile, districts are gathering opinions, surveying teachers, parents, and kids, asking how they feel it went and what they'd like to see if remote learning is needed this fall. Today in The Exchange, we ask you to weigh in on schooling from home. Tell us what worked, what didn't, and what lessons might be applied to the upcoming academic year. Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or give us a call. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Our guests are Elizabeth Darlington, special educator at Richmond Middle School in Hanover, also Scott LaLiberty, superintendent for Londonderry School District, and Bow Superintendent Dean Cascaden. Welcome to all of you. And Dean, I want to start with you. You're an educator, so how would you grade your community's experience with remote learning?
Well, I'm going to take the COVID cop-out and go pass-fail, and we're going to take a pass on this. I think it was incredibly amazing. I was on the chairlift at Bretton Woods the day that the governor announced this. We planned one day and implemented the next and turned to remote learning and just very, very, very quickly. I think you know, learning is fundamentally experience-based, it's communal and it's social, and we did a pretty good job of trying to replicate that in a very quick fashion in a digital manner. You know, I think about when cars first started coming onto the scene, they were called horseless carriages, and that's what they look like. They look like a carriage without a horse, and I think what we tried to do is replicate the classroom that we had online and make it work. And there were some things that worked in there, and there were some things that definitely didn't work. And later on in the program, as we talk about moving forward, we'll talk about some of the good things and some of the things we've learned from this experience.
Well, pass fail. I think I understand where you're coming from there, Dean. And it was such a quick turnaround. By the way, I'm just curious, why did you guys decide to turn around so quickly? Concord took a week to give teachers a chance to sort of get up and running.
We felt momentum was key. One of the things that one of the things that we were concerned about is the more time that we took off between being in school live and starting a remote, the more people would get into the habit of not doing things and not being engaged. So we felt even though we were going to build the plane as we were flying it and we had to make some adjustments on the fly, we felt getting people engaged and started and moving forward as quick as possible was going to be helpful with the momentum building.
Well,
we were already well prepared to go there, so we were better than some districts.
We'll definitely talk about the motivation issue because I know that has been a factor in some households. Scott, how about you? How would you grade Londonderry?
Well, I think if I were going to be fair, I would probably separate out our performance from our effort. I would go with a solid B for performance. Like Dean, we had a lot of people work very hard under a short time frame. And I think given that, given those conditions, I think we did pretty well. We recognize there are a lot of ways in which we can improve. As an effort, it's got to be an A for effort. I mean, our parents, our students, and our teachers just worked so hard to make this work and really maximize the resources and opportunities that they had. So I'd separate the two of them out because I would want to recognize the amount of work that went into it, just by everyone involved.
And just remind us, Scott, Londonderry is a very large district. How many kids, how many schools are you in charge of?
We have 4,241 students that are distributed over six schools. We have one high school, one 6-8 middle school. We have 3 1-5 elementary schools, and we have a pre-K K building.
Wow. And Elizabeth, how about you as a special educator? And by the way, a mom yourself of three kids, so you were teaching and teaching at the same time. What's the biggest takeaway for you, Elizabeth, from this whole experiment?
Oh gosh, there have been so many takeaways. I think what was the most powerful for us in terms of impact was working together as a team and really recognizing the fact that we needed to work directly with parents. We needed to improve our communication skills. We needed to find more creative ways to deliver information and materials. There's just so many things that were exciting to experience through this remote learning, and also the challenges that we found, in particular, making sure that every single student was accounted for and checking in with them on a regular basis if we found that they were sort of falling off of the radar, how to do that.
That's interesting, Elizabeth. So you used the word exciting. The word that I've heard from a lot of teachers is exhausting. So what was exciting for you?
The exciting part was the challenge of just taking on something completely new, unexpected. You know, like everyone else, March 13th, regular school day. And then by the end of the weekend, everybody just kind of got the feeling that things were going to change. And we didn't know how long that was going to be, but how are we going to make this work? What was going to be our focus? What was going to be the most important thing that we could do in order to help our kids be the most successful that they can be?
You know, we here at NHPR did a survey of parents, but also of educators, asking educators in New Hampshire what they learned about themselves during the school closure. And one of the most frequent comments we got was how much teachers value that face-to-face interaction with students. And I want to share a couple comments that we received from teachers. Beth at Richmond Middle School, where you are, Elizabeth, says, I have learned a lot during this time. I feel I am in a constant state of self-reflection. I have learned how much we depend on the energy of the students and feed off of each other every day. So that's from Beth. We also heard from Sarah. She's at Hanover High. Sarah says, I have learned how much I rely on my students' input and the stimulating unpredictability of the classroom to keep students engaged. As an art teacher, Sarah says, I use spontaneity and in-the-moment realizations to help fuel student creativity and to validate individual voices. It's much harder to pivot quickly and respond to the momentum generated by students in an online environment. So that's Sarah. She teaches at Hanover High. And here's one more. This is Anne at Berlin Middle High School. Anne says, I figured out how much of my own energy is tied to being with other people. Holding Zoom meetings and leaving feedback on a Google Doc drains me of energy and interest. I'm teaching, but I can't imagine it's any better for my students. Dean, what did you hear from your teachers in Bow about just the value of that human interaction, you know, physical people sitting together in the same physical space?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you think about the system that we developed and the type of people that we hired and the type of people that we developed to teach class, they're able to handle 25 active either children or middle schoolers or high schoolers in one room and keep them engaged and occupied for 45 minutes to 90 minutes. Most people, that would exhaust them. I mean, one of the things you see when people come into this profession is they sleep a lot, because you have that incredible amount of interaction. I mean, 25 kids and you and 25 kids interacting with the 24 other kids in the classroom. It's just a very complex social dynamic. You know, good teachers have this thing we call with-itness. They're able to talk to one kid and keep an eye on the kid in the back row and slowly and maybe go over to a desk and give that old teacher eye to the third kid. And they're managing 25 kids and keeping them, you know, engaged and active. And when they went online, that was just a whole different experience to try to do. I mean, you know, we're doing this talk show today, and I've done them with you before, and it's so different here sitting alone in my office and not having that interaction. I think that was very different, and that was our difficulty is, you know, how do we take something that was very highly evolved and fine-tuned for the face-to-face and turn it into a remote and digital experience with any fidelity.
So Dean, it's not just a skill set, you know, something you can learn perhaps, it's a whole personality that a good teacher has in that classroom and may not be transferable to an online environment.
Well, you know, one of the things I look at is, you know, if we want to have really good online digital learning, then we need to hire people who know how to create that. When, you know, I've had great online digital learning and there are wonderful videos and interactions and all this sort of stuff. Those aren't the people that we hire to be in front of 25 kids face to face. And so as we move forward, we have to realize that these are totally different environments. And yeah, the people who are employed by us, they have an amazing skill set and it may not translate well to the digital world.
Well, we got an email from Jeff who says, I'm a science teacher at Portsmouth High School, and I found the distance learning extremely challenging as I had to try and rewrite labs so they could be done at home with simple supplies, and I was never able to give an assessment that I was confident the students did not collaborate on. I'm exhausted, Jeff says. I'm hoping that the return plan in the fall will include some class time for hands-on experiences and in-person assessments. And we will definitely talk, Jeff, a little bit later in the show about, you know, possibilities for the fall. But what about what he says, Scott? I think that this environment was especially challenging for science teachers because they do have that hands-on learning. You know, you've got to pour beaker one into beaker two and see if it explodes. So how did you get around that in Londonderry? I hope it doesn't explode.
Well, I think he's hit on a key element of what we try to do, certainly in science, where we want people actively engaged. But, you know, a lot of the work that we're doing with performance assessments and with redesign of classroom experiences, it has become much more active. It has become much more hands-on because we know that our students, the students that we are working with today, are not necessarily going to be engaged by, you know, what was called in the vernacular in the old days as sit and get, right?
Yeah, or chalk
and
talk.
That's not going to work anymore. Yeah, just sit there and listen. So certainly science, it was challenged by this kind of an alteration in their design. But I think a lot of other disciplines were as well, because not only does this fly in the face of that particular content area, but it flies in the face of what we know to be best practice as far as teaching and learning goes. And that's something I know a lot of our teachers expressed some frustration with that as well. You're missing that, you know, building off of what Dean was talking about, you're missing that, the interpersonal art. We know that teaching is as much an art as it is a science, and developing those personal relationships with your students, engaging them and challenging them in real time. It's not the same on Zoom or Google Meets or something like that. So I think there would be a lot of teachers who would echo that. And I know I've spoken to a lot in our district who feel the same way, that is part of what wore them down.
What's so interesting, Scott, is, you know, for the past 5 years at least, I've been doing shows on a move to incorporate more hands-on learning to get away from the so-called chalk and talk. You know, there's been an emphasis by the state and districts on outside the classroom experiences, internships, you know, mentorships and so forth. And again, a big emphasis on group work in the classroom and getting your hands on the material. This completely throws that up in the air, Scott. It's the complete opposite.
It absolutely does. And I think that's part of why it really was a big shift for all of us, because we took all of those tools that we know to be so effective, and we basically said you can't use any of these anymore. You know, you can't go out of your house. You have to stay home. You have to limit your interaction to the virtual world. So, I think there were a lot of teachers who were impacted by that. I know there were a lot of students who were impacted by that. And that gets into the wellness piece a little bit. But it was all part of the dynamic of what made this so challenging.
Well, we'll definitely talk about the wellness piece. That has been huge, huge, huge from what I've heard from educators. Jeff, thank you for writing in that email. You can email us as well. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Or you can give us a call. Tell us how remote learning went in your household. And if it is necessary in the fall, how you think it might be made better. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. Email us, exchange@nhpr.org. And Elizabeth, let's talk about the social and emotional piece of this that Scott just mentioned. Many, many, many parents, teachers, pediatricians have told us how concerned they are about the isolation that remote learning involved. So you've been tracking this for your school, Elizabeth. What did you see?
Well, there were certainly kids who struggled. The isolation piece was really hard. Middle schoolers are hardwired to want to be social, and that is a huge part of the middle school experience. So we, as a sixth grade team, made sure that we were keeping in touch and in contact with every single one of our students. Every single day. We met as a homeroom every day, just for that reason, to just kind of take the pulse of where everybody was socially, emotionally, and whether or not there were some red flags that were presenting themselves as we were having these smaller informal conversations. And then our guidance counselors worked overtime to make sure that everybody had somebody that they could turn to. It was a big push in our district and within our school to emphasize contact over content. And that made a huge difference in how we were working with our students. That was the driving force of this whole remote learning time.
That's interesting, Elizabeth. Contact over content. And certainly as this experiment continued into, you know, week 4, 5, 6, I heard that from more teachers that they were, you know, 2 months in, really just focused on making sure that the kids were okay. I don't want to say setting aside the content, but very much focused on emotional health. I wonder how you sort of evolved on that, Elizabeth.
Well, certainly worked on making sure that the kids that we were concerned about had additional supports put in place immediately. Teachers went out of their way to meet with kids one-on-one, to follow up with emails, to get in touch with parents. There was a whole lot of people who were working together to make sure that kids were continuing to feel supported and parents were feeling supported. And of course, the emotional health is the driving force behind any educational experience for any student. If they're feeling strong and confident, they're going to do well in school. If they're feeling isolated and alone, they're going to check out and not be participating. So it was a big endeavor, but I think that we did a good job of making sure that kids were feeling like we were there for them.
Well, and we'll talk a little bit later about that important contact and how teachers at the upper levels do that when they see so many kids in a particular day. We're going to talk in a few minutes to a high school chemistry teacher. But let's take a call first. This is Veronica from Bethlehem. Veronica, thank you for being with us today. Go ahead. Veronica, good morning. Are you on the air with us from Bethlehem?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead, Veronica.
So my son just finished his freshman year in high school and was lucky enough to take an AP class, but he was finishing his schoolwork in under 2 hours every day and isn't really sure why he should have to go back inside a school building if it takes so little time for him to actually do the work.
That's interesting, Veronica. Thank you very much for calling in. And Dean, I'll turn to you first. He's saying, look, I got it all done in 2 hours. Why should I spend 7 hours at the school? Some kids did get this work done pretty quickly without all the switching gears for class and, you know, dealing with assemblies and, you know, lunch and so forth. What are your thoughts there, Dean?
Well, one of my favorite sayings was never let school get in the way of your education by Mark Twain. And I used to think it was a lot more funny before it became a requirement. You know, I think there are kids who did really, really well in remote learning, and this student may be one of them. Kids, and he's taking AP courses, obviously got some self-motivated and some support. But when I look at what we're trying to teach in schools, it's so much more than just the classes and academics. I mean, I always refer to our sports and clubs as co-curriculars, not extracurriculars, because of the things we're learning in the social emotional realm and how to get along with people, how to come into the community and how to interact with other people. So yeah, there were kids who I think this was great for, and you didn't have to deal with all of the school that sometimes get in the way of education, you know, changing classes and commuting in and out and buses and lunches, and got all my work done. I could do what I wanted to do. And that was definitely a part of the people that we heard from, part of one end of the bell curve. The other end of the bell curve was they absolutely fell apart in this environment. Without the structure of school, without the social motivation of coming in and seeing their classmates, without their ability to interact with people, they just completely shut down and weren't able to do any work. So, you know, I think that's one of the takeaways is, you know, we need to do a little bit better in choice and a little bit better in meeting kids in their unique ways of being educated.
That's so interesting what you say, Dean. And I want to ask Scott, too, what you think, because there has been a lot of concern in society broadly that we're all kind of more and more living in our own little rabbit holes. We're looking at our own little social media feeds. We're only talking and hearing from people just like us. And, you know, Dean's comment and Veronica's call kind of makes me think that this is exacerbating that broader societal trend. And I wonder what you think, Scott, that this is narrowing us instead of broadening us.
Yeah, it most certainly narrows the scope of our world. As I think about some of the challenges that we will need to overcome as we think about what we're calling the possibility of remote learning 2.0, the design of instructional design and the learning experiences that we design, I think by and large, because of the quick pivot, because of the short time frame, we went to the easiest and most readily available resources that we had. And I won't speak certainly for people out, but I know we worked pretty hard to do the best we could with what we had. And I hope in our next iteration, and as we think that that's going to happen at some point, we expect that we can look for ways to vary our instructional approaches, bring in resources from the outside, and challenge some of those other students. Because I think you're right, some of the students who didn't respond well wound up experiencing more isolation, wound up experiencing more frustration. And even some of the students who really gravitated towards this, they were able to fly through their work without real challenge, you know, real engagement. I think the answer to that becomes instructional design. And making sure that our teachers are supported and that they have what they need to be able to vary up their instructional approach. For me, that's the next step beyond that.
Well, coming up, we're going to talk to a high school science teacher. She'll give her perspective on how remote learning went for her and thoughts about the fall, what you just called, Scott, remote learning 2.0. We'll take a lot more of your calls and emails as well, so keep them coming in and stay on the line if you're already there. Our number is 1-800-892-6477, and we'll be right back. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, remote learning. 3 months ago, students, teachers, and parents were abruptly thrown into a school-from-home environment. This hour, we're asking New Hampshire educators what worked, what didn't, and lessons learned that might apply during the upcoming academic year, given the possibility that remote learning becomes necessary again. Let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests for the hour are Elizabeth Darlington. She's a special educator at Richmond Middle School in Hanover. Also, Scott LaLiberty. He's Londonderry's superintendent. And also with us, Bow School Superintendent Dean Cascaden. And with us now is Megan Cleary. She teaches chemistry at Hollis Brookline High School. And Megan, welcome. Great to have you.
Thanks, Laura. Laura. Thanks for having me.
So high school teachers typically have a lot of students, you know, cycling in and out all day long. How many students did you have for chemistry this year, Megan?
I actually didn't have as many as I've had in the past. I think in total between all five of my classes, I had only 70 students in total.
Okay, 70 students is still a lot. At least it sounds like a lot to me. And we've been talking about the importance of staying in touch with students during remote learning, you know, not just academically, but also that social emotional piece. How feasible was that for you, Megan, given that you had 70 students to keep track of?
Yeah, it was really challenging. And I think that was probably the toughest part of remote learning is not being present during their learning process. So in order to stay in touch with my students and then also to be mindful of how many other hours they're putting into their other classes, I would just do a weekly question that I would throw up on Google Classroom. And I was looking for them to really kind of reflect on what the question was. Sometimes they were silly questions like, you know, what do you like about summer? But sometimes they were more interesting questions that allowed students to kind of bring out their personality. And I would say that from that, I had a lot of students who would typically be quiet during the year, sharing all these wonderful life stories with me. So that was a positive, getting to kind of play into their strength, which is, you know, shining on the internet sometimes.
That's really interesting. And, you know, we've been talking again about the challenges of this, but it sounds like you found some positives, Megan, in that students who normally wouldn't speak up in class, you know, because they're shy or they feel like they'll be judged, they were comfortable sending you a paragraph describing something about their personal lives or their personality.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I mean, the good thing was that this didn't happen, you know, September 1st. We were able to have three quarters to have that rapport with our students and that bond with our students. So students who may have thought, and I thought that we had a good bond, but we just didn't have a good verbal bond, were really able to communicate well with me through that. I mean, there was a lot of really bad negative things about remote learning, so you have to find the wonderful positive things. And I think being able to communicate with the students who I didn't typically communicate with was one of the highest positives.
Well, there's always a couple kids in each class who are the big talkers, and so they tend to get most of the attention. And so that's interesting to hear you say that. In terms of the content, Megan, how did you present it? We heard earlier from got an email from a science teacher, Jeff, in Portsmouth, who said, you know, doing labs was really tough. So how did you transmit this information that kids need to know about chemistry?
Yeah, it was awful. Chemistry is not designed to be learned over the internet. So, I mean, quarter four is usually the most challenging quarter. The material starts to get very complex. We're building off of the first three quarters. So we're taking everything that we learned in September, October, and November and putting it to use. So with the lab situation, I was able to access some online simulations that they were able to do. And I was able to modify some of the labs that I would typically give at school. But the labs are really hard and complex in school, and so modifying for them for home use is not very simple. And so I feel like a lot of the major concepts that go along with the labs were missed out on because we weren't able to talk about the labs together while they were performing it. So, yeah, that's how we did the labs. I think the at-home chemistry wasn't the most accessible for everyone. I mean, a lot of students don't have the resources that we would be able to use in our typical labs, even with household materials. Still, students needed to go out and purchase things, which I was very mindful of.
Sure. Well, and I remember signing permission slips for my own kids' chemistry classes. And, you know, there's all sorts of safety stuff about, you know, we're going to be using this chemical and that chemical and mixing stuff. And there's concern about burns and all that and proper eyewear. And I just, like, how did you even get around that? Or did you just kind of, I don't want to say give up, Megan, but you know where I'm going.
Yeah, no, the safety was, I mean, luckily for this quarter and the household materials, you know, most of the things that people have at home are safe. But we did do a lab where I recommended bleach, and I wrote like a whole paragraph on like how to handle bleach and not mixing it with this and not mixing it with that. But they're also, I mean, I'm not teaching 7-year-olds, so I do feel fine giving my 17, 16-year-olds the permission to go use their stoves and a knife at home to cut things. I expect that they are able to do that well, especially if their parents are there guiding them.
Most districts, as you know, Megan, are starting to talk about the possibility of some type of remote learning in the fall. One of our guests earlier called it, you know, remote learning 2.0. Maybe it's hybrid. Maybe it's, you know, half online and half in person, with the possibility of all remote again if there's another spike in COVID-19 infections. If that's the case, Megan, what would help you make this the best experience it could be?
I think the best way that I could get supported is to have mandated online classes. And what I mean by that is not maybe 7 periods a day, but at least 2 times a day I get to meet with my class periods. I think the hardest part, again, was not being present during their learning process. And I know that a lot of students struggled to create their own schedules, and they felt very overwhelmed by the amount of work that they had to do. And if we gave them 2 periods a day where we say from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m., you're doing chemistry homework with me, and then from 1 p.m. to 2 p.m., you're doing your English homework with your English teacher, and just providing some structure for them, I think would be able, they would be able to kind of minimize those anxieties. It also gives them the range and ability to reach out immediately and ask questions. So if we're doing something over Zoom, they can send me a question via the chat, or they can ask me in person instead of having to email me and question, should I be emailing her or should I just try to figure this out on my own? It minimizes that questioning, so they're able to just get the interactions that they need immediately.
So even though some kids said they really enjoyed, quote unquote, working on their own time, you're saying, Megan, give them some structure. You know, you got it. First of all, you have to get out of bed before 10 o'clock, you know, and you have to show up on that Zoom meeting or whatever at 9 for this, for an hour. You got to have your video on. You have to be engaged. So just waking up, putting on some type of clothing and getting online and being there live. You're saying that's really important.
Yeah, and I don't know if that needs to happen every single day for every single class. I think speaking for Hollis, Brookline, we did a pretty good job navigating and delineating what students should be doing throughout the week. But if we are able to do some kind of in-person classes that are mandated, and then also being able to give them some free time to do their, you know, come up with their own schedule for the remaining days of the week for that class. It kind of plays to both people's advantages. The students who like making their schedules continue to make their own schedules, but they have to follow some kind of structure. And the students who need structure, well, we're giving them some structure, and they may need to do some work on their own, but their teachers are still there to help them form that structure with them.
So last question for you, Megan, and again, it's been great to talk to you. Any other thoughts about what you and your colleagues have learned from all this and how you might apply that to the possible return of remote learning? You already talked about some structure, some you have to show up at this time and this time. Anything else, Megan, that you have learned that you might apply to, you know, possible remote learning 2.0?
Yeah, I would say that in the classroom, I'm not going to say I'm strict, but I hold my students to a high rigor. And I do that on purpose because chemistry is very hard. And so if they're able to, you know, kind of fall behind the class, they're not going to be able to catch up without putting in a lot of extra work. And although that's worked really well for me in the past, during remote learning, I've had to take a much more modified approach and kind of meet students where they are. And so it's really having more compassion for the students and understanding of where they're coming from when they're saying that they're unable to do things. So moving forward, even if we aren't remote learning or we're back in the classrooms or wherever we are, it's really just been a good lesson in empathy for me in working with students wherever they may present.
Thank you very much, Megan, for being with us. And good luck to you no matter what happens with learning in the fall. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Megan Cleary. She teaches chemistry at Hollis Brookline High School. Again, today in The Exchange, we want your questions and comments and experiences with remote learning this spring and how it might be made better if it is necessary this fall. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. 6477. And all of you, Erin is calling in from Boscawen. Hi, Erin. You're on the air. Go ahead. Thank you for being with us.
Hi. Thanks for allowing me to chat for a second. I teach in Concord, and I also do some consulting stuff with social emotional learning. And one of the things that I keep thinking about and talking about with colleagues is figuring out the equity gap that we're seeing and my worries around the haves and the have-nots. Teaching second grade in a school where we have many, many languages and lots of families who have just come to the United States, it was really quite an experience to figure out how to advocate for and help students who can't do their learning independently. We have kids learning how to read, kids learning how to write, do math, and we have families that are kind of in survival mode. And we have a lot of families who parents are there and able to support their kids, and we have a lot of families who parents are not in a position to help and support the youngest learners. So that's something that was a real struggle as a teacher, and it's something that I just keep thinking about as we go into the next school year.
Wow, Erin, so you had a real range of kids who had a range of support at home. You know, without, you can't walk in and change somebody's home situation, but how did you as an educator try to do the best you could in those situations?
One of the things that I found really beneficial was, even though the kids I work with are so young, they're usually more tech savvy than me. And so being able to do video chats with them, we use something called Seesaw, and the kids were able to post things. I did Google Meet. They were hilarious because, again, depending on the kids' understanding of what to do and support at home, sometimes someone would be running through the living room with an iPad. Sometimes kids would be eating their breakfast while they're talking to me. But face-to-face was really helpful for me to get kind of a quick look into how they seem to be doing emotionally overall. And then getting creative. I know it wasn't just me. A lot of people quietly this spring were doing things like driveway visits and sitting 10 feet away and just chatting with the student and seeing how they are. And sometimes that would be a writing lesson, and sometimes that would be, how are you doing? And they tell me that, you know, they're having nightmares and they're scared. Sometimes it was really working hard on checking in with the parents. And that's an area that's always been hard for me, but really pushing to be present with the parents and check in, and what can I do to help? And how are you? How are you doing? And a lot of parents were really overwhelmed, understandably so.
Wow, Erin, you stopped by some of your kids' homes and just did a face-to-face visit with them, you know, distant, but you're kind of acting like a social worker there. Wow.
I think so much of what we do, all of us as teachers, especially, you know, just thinking about the youngest learners who are new to all of this, is finding ways to get them to feel like they're significant and feel like they belong to a greater community. And that, for me, was the biggest challenge this spring, was making sure that they feel heard and seen, and they have a relationship that they can lean on. Because if we don't have that relationship, then the learning isn't going to move forward.
So I'm so glad you called, Erin, again, because you work with the younger kids. We just heard from Megan, who works with high schoolers. So I'm glad you called. What's your advice or message to your district as it considers the possibility of some remote learning in the fall?
I think two things have been swirling around in my head. My husband teaches middle school, so we've been kind of comparing notes. But one thing I think we need to be mindful of, and I'm impressed that I think our district is already thinking about this, is looking at younger kids. Developmentally, they're impulsive. They're not thinking ahead, and it's hard enough for adults to remember the social distancing rules. So we have to be really careful about, what does this feel like for a 6-, 7-, or 8-year-old, or a 5-year-old, which is a whole other story. And I think the other thing is that we need to roll up our sleeves and spend some time and money and energy, which, again, I know our district is already starting some of these plans, but we need to sit down and look at the whole child socially, emotionally, academically. Where is this child? What do they need to be successful? And what supports and scaffolds need to be in place to make sure that they can move forward at whatever pace that is? And part of that is also looking at how we assess students, because if we're not teaching them the way we always have, and we can't be there with them the way that we should be, we have to rethink that completely.
All right. It's great to hear from you, Erin. Thank you very much for calling in.
Thank you so much. Bye.
So after a short break, I will get your thoughts on what Erin told us, working with younger kids, working with teenagers. So we'll definitely talk about that, all of you. And we'll take a lot more calls and emails. Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, lessons learned from an unprecedented spring of remote learning and how those might apply to the fall, with many districts looking at the possibility of having to do some remote instruction in the upcoming academic year. Exchange listeners, let's hear from you. If remote learning is necessary this fall, how do you think it could be improved? What do you want to see happen, again, based on your experience with the spring? Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook or call in 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Elizabeth Darlington, learning specialist at Richmond Middle School in Hanover, also Scott LaLiberty, superintendent in Londonderry, and in Bow, superintendent Dean Cascaden. And all of you, here's an email from Ken that came in that I think we really need to address. Ken says, the governor needs to allocate enough of the $1+ billion federal funds already received to guarantee that the 2021 school year will begin with 100% student access to high-speed, high-quality internet. Ken says that access includes affordability, i.e. all families that qualify for free or reduced lunches for their children shall have free high-speed internet in their homes. We haven't really hit this on the head, all of you, and I do want to ask, and I think I'll turn to you first, Elizabeth, what did you see in terms of kids' capability to just access the internet? If we're going to do it online, they need to have both the hardware and the connection to make it possible.
It was certainly a challenge for some of our families. Just the wide span of Hanover in general, our students who lived out in Aetna, their connection was definitely not at the same place as the kids who lived in town. So that was a challenge. We also had challenges with kids who had multiple siblings in the household who had Zoom calls scheduled at the same time with other teachers and parents who were working at the same time as their students. So trying to keep all the technology working was a big challenge. I think not a day went by without somebody dropping a call or listening to them became really garbled or a delay with the visual. So I think that made it definitely more difficult to stay tied to our students.
Yeah, it's hard when you're trying to focus on a classroom and half the people are breaking up. What do you think, Scott? What was your experience with families reporting technical challenges? You know, they wanted to do it, but they just couldn't do it.
Well, I mean, we're fortunate in the southern part of the state to have pretty good coverage as far as our internet service goes. And we did get some help with securing internet access to some families that weren't able to access it. But I think Elizabeth hit the nail on the head. When you see this kind of demand, it does slow down service. We had the same experience. We had parents and students all on the same access point. And it was an inhibiting factor. We tried to utilize our digital resources as best we could, but I think a lot of our teachers kept that in mind, that it wasn't completely reliable. And another thing that we talked a lot about too is we did not want this to become entirely online school, if you will. We tried to have students incorporate some more active in-person type of activities and that sort of thing, where we could to minimize that screen time as much as we could. But to your point,
well,
as far as access
goes, Scott,
we had same experience. Yeah.
Yeah. So that is interesting. And especially with the younger kids, you know, we talk about remote learning and we assume it's all online, but I have heard that especially with younger kids, some teachers did deliver sort of book bags and activity bags and so forth. So what did you do that was not digital, Scott? I'm interested in that.
Well, your previous caller had a great point as far as the primary age learners. And I know that a lot of our primary teachers did primarily material that was non-digital, if you will. We ran school buses to deliver some of those materials. We had people in paraprofessional roles who were able to come in and assist us with that. So we were able to maintain a flow of some work as far as pencil and paper, if you will, and teachers were very creative as far as coming up with activities that got kids up and moving in that same way. As you said, that, you know, a 6 or 7 year old is not necessarily going to be in their optimal environment staring at a computer screen for 6 hours. So
yeah,
we do have some digital resources, but we tried to balance it.
Well, and we got a comment from Sarah who says, I live in a semi-rural area. We need to make sure that all teachers and students have the same access to the internet. Right now, I have students, Sarah says, who simply cannot get online or their connections are unreliable. It raises serious questions about equity when some students are at an immediate disadvantage and they cannot access the curriculum in the same way. So, Sarah, thank you for writing in. Let's take another caller, folks. And Carol is on the line. Hi, Carol. You're on the air. Thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you for having me. Can you hear me all right?
Sure can. Go ahead, Carol.
So my son has autism spectrum disorder, which means that he follows an IEP. Part of the range of services that he receives include behavioral, physical therapy, occupational therapy, paraprofessional, things like that. And part of the issue that I'm having is that this system has exposed that I don't believe this is equal learning opportunity for individuals who are not neurotypical or, for example, what if you're in a foster home and you only have one computer to share amongst everyone? We did come from an area of homelessness, and to have to go through a COVID crisis again where he cannot be in a learning environment would genuinely devastate us. As it stands, he is not participating in summer school this year because I have to work, or we're going to end up homeless. So how is it we're going to address vulnerable populations so it is, in fact, equal opportunity for everyone?
Wow, Carol. So you have been homeless or close to homelessness. Sounds like living on the edge, and you need to work.
Correct. And it's not fair that I had to have to pick between keeping a roof over our head and my son's long-term education. Because if he's not in school, he regresses. And that's his long-term future that is now on hold just to be able to pay the bill.
You know, I am so glad that you called, Carol, and my very best wishes to you. And we should talk about this, folks. And Dean, to you first, you know, I think everybody just kind of did what they needed to do in sort of emergency mode in the spring. But Carol's right, Dean. You know, there are people who cannot do this again in the fall. They cannot. They have two kids or one kid or several kids, and they must work. And so for districts to say, well, half remote and, you know, your six-year-old will be fine home alone. Well, no, he won't. So what are you talking about with your leaders in your district, Dean, about people like Carol who cannot do this again?
Well, she's brought up, I think, one of the major issues that has come up here was equity. In my own district, I'm pushing to get students into our building as much as possible. As a superintendent, I push to have our extended school year program as much face-to-face as possible. Took a little flack for that. It's like, you know, how can you bring kids in? What are you going to do for PPE? What are you going to do for masks? We need to get these students into the schools because that's where I believe they're best served. This parent is right. Her child comes to school. We have a bunch of specialists. Oftentimes we may have a one-on-one aide with this child. We have a number of adults who are working with the child with special needs, like possibly her child is. And that just didn't happen in remote instruction. It was like, okay, we'll provide you this resource, but you know, parents of younger children and parents of children with special needs, they had a much more difficult time with this. And, you know, they need the support in order for them to have equitable opportunity. I mean, I hear what she's saying. In my own district, I'm pushing as much as possible to have kids into the building as quickly as we can. And, well, trying to keep them safe, you know, trying to keep students with special needs or young children 6 feet separated by 6 feet. Well, good luck with that. But we got to give it a try because I think that's where we need to be.
Well, and Dean, as you know, we are at a time in our society where we're focusing a lot more on inequality and inequality in terms of opportunity. And here's Carol, you know, quite low income. Her son is not doing a summer program because she has to work. Her spring was already, you know, extremely stressful because of this. So here's an here's an occasion where her son is not getting equal treatment because she has to work. So I just wonder what you think about this in terms of our current focus on inequality, both, you know, inequality of opportunity among people who are poor, among people of different races and ethnic groups and so forth. I mean, this is kind of highlighting these inequalities.
Yeah, let me, you know, I'm a firm believer in public education as the driver of equity in our country. I mean, you go back to Brown versus Board of Education, that separate is inherently unequal. And in this time of remote learning, we've been forced into separateness. And that has brought on a bunch of unequal situations. I think it's interesting in New Hampshire, we have the START Committee, which is talking about how to reopen schools. And there's two R's in START. There's redesign and reopening. And there's been a little bit of politics being played in the redesign part, because if you look at the Federal Department of Education with Betsy DeVoe, the funds have been held up because it's arguing about charter schools. And a little bit in New Hampshire, the redesign is a little bit kind of, people are wary of that because it's a redesign to charters and it's a redesign to non-public school entities. And in my mind, we do need to redesign because we need to go to that remote instruction 2.0. But in my mind also, we can't lose the sight of public education, provided to all, equal opportunity to all. And we need to figure out how to deal with the issue that she has brought up. This situation was thrust on us. It is definitely a situation of haves and have-nots. Bowen Dunbarton, where I'm superintendent, we had a one-to-one initiative to begin with. Our kids have computers. We have pretty good internet. We have a lot of people who are able to stay home with their kids and support them in remote learning. We probably had, as far as situations go, we probably did okay with remote learning, but look at all of the advantages we have to begin with. So I think that equity issue has to be forefront, but I think the solution is we solve it through the public school system.
Well, here's an email from Jessica who says, as a single mother of three kids working from home during the pandemic, distant learning, Jessica says, had some challenges, but also some wins. My kids range from kindergarten to sixth grade. Finding consistent resources that allow children to learn a lesson and test their knowledge, especially for the younger kids, is crucial. One of the biggest hurdles, Jessica says, is that younger kids don't have basic computer skills to be successful. Writing a story now requires it to be typed into a Google Doc, which can make a rather simple assignment take significantly longer. Working these skills into the curriculum for the fall is not only useful for distant learning, but will be a strong life skill to help kids be more versatile in the future. Jessica, thank you for writing in. Wow, single mom, three kids, working from home during the pandemic. Elizabeth, I know you have kids. How did you manage to teach your students and teach your kids? And based on that experience, what's your hope for the fall?
Well, we established a routine pretty quickly so that all of us were working on schoolwork from 10 to 2. And my kids range in ages from 12 to 18. And even if their schoolwork was completed before somebody else's was, if my sixth grader finished before the 12th grader or I was still in the middle of a Zoom meeting, we set aside those 4 hours as really the time that everybody needed to be working on something related to school. And moving forward into the fall, I mean, I am super, super hopeful that we will be back in the building. But within our school, we're taking these 2 weeks of time where it's just us as a staff thinking about how we can move forward in ways that are related to how we can improve things within the building, as well as how we can improve things in remote learning, and taking a look at 4 big topics of communication, technology, student services, and social emotional support, and thinking about how we can apply those big topics. No matter what the fall looks like, how can we do that better?
Scott LaLiberty, last question for you. What are you guys talking about now in Londonderry? Obviously, no one knows what the end of August is going to look like, but what are some of the scenarios that you're putting forward?
Well, it is an overwhelming process because we really aren't sure what we'll be coming back to.
Right.
But as I'm sure is the case in most other districts, we have come up with a structure to make it a little bit more manageable. What we are doing right now is we're doing some research on really four different scenarios. One would be remaining in remote instruction, which no one is hoping for. But we want to make sure we learn our lessons from this time and improve. We are looking at what it would be like were we to return fully to school with social distancing in place. So we're doing some research into that as well. And then the other two that we're looking at are either a hybrid schedule where some students are in at different times or a staggered return. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to make sense of it by bringing some structure to it and do some research.
Well, all of you, there's so much more we could have talked about, and we'll have to check back with you, you know, right before school begins, because there are a lot of questions out there. For now, we'll wrap it up. I want to thank everybody for being with us. Elizabeth, it was great to talk to you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
That's Elizabeth Darlington. She's a learning specialist at Richmond Middle School in Hanover. Scott LaLiberty, great to talk to you too. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me on.
That's Scott LaLiberty. He's superintendent for the Londonderry School District. And Dean Cascaden, always good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Remember the word hybrid. That's where we're going to
go. All right. We will check in with you later, Dean, on that for sure. That's Dean Cascaden. He's Bowes School District Superintendent. And this is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.